We have to be practical, Dr. Ferris kept saying. We have to be scientific. I need the economy of the country as a whole, Wesley Mooch kept repeating. I need the production of a nation. Is it economics that you're talking about? Is it production? She said whenever her cold, measured voice was able to seize a brief stretch of their time. If it is, then give us leeway to save the eastern states. That's all that's left of the country and of the world. If you let us save that, we'll have a chance to rebuild the rest. If not, it's the end. Let the Atlantic Southern take care of such transcontinental traffic as still exists. Let the local railroads take care of the Northwest. But let Taggart Transcontinental drop everything else, yes, everything, and devote all our resources, equipment, and rail to the traffic of the eastern states. Let us shrink back to the start of this country, but let us hold that start. We'll run no trains west of the Missouri. We'll become a local railroad, the local of the industrial east. Let us save our industries. There's nothing left to save in the West. You can run agriculture for centuries by manual labor and ox carts, but destroy the last of this country's industrial plant, and centuries of effort won't be able to rebuild it or to gather the economic strength to make a start. How do you expect our industries or railroads to survive without steel? How do you expect any steel to be produced if you cut off the supply of iron ore? Save Minnesota, whatever's left of it. The country? You have no country to save if its industries perish. You can sacrifice a leg or an arm. You can't save a body by sacrificing its heart and brain. Save our industries. Save Minnesota. Save the eastern seaboard. It was no use. She said it as many times, with as many details, statistics, figures, proofs, as she could force out of her weary mind into their evasive hearing. It was no use. They neither refuted nor agreed. They merely looked as if her arguments were beside the point. There was a sound of hidden emphasis in their answers, as if they were giving her an explanation, but in a code to which she had no key.
There's trouble in California, said Wesley Mooch, sullenly. Their state legislature's been acting pretty huffy. There's talk of seceding from the Union.
Oregon is overrun by gangs of deserters, said Clem Weatherby cautiously. They murdered two tax collectors within the last 3 months.
The importance of industry to a civilization has been grossly overemphasized, said Dr. Ferris dreamily. What is now known as the People's State of India has existed for centuries without any industrial development whatever.
People could do with fewer material gadgets and a sterner discipline of privations, said Eugene Lawson eagerly. It would be good for them.
Oh, hell, are you going to let that dame talk you into letting the richest country on earth slip through your fingers? Said Cuffy Meggs, leaping to his feet. It's a fine time to give up a whole continent in exchange for what? For a dinky little state that's milked dry anyway. I say ditch Minnesota, but hold on to your transcontinental dragnet. With trouble and riots everywhere, you won't be able to keep people in line unless you have transportation. Troop transportation. Unless you hold your soldiers within a few days' journey of any point on the continent. This is no time to retrench. Don't get yellow listening to all that talk. You've got the country in your pocket. Just keep it there.
In the long run, Mooch started uncertainly.
In the long run, we'll all be dead, snapped Cuffy Meggs.
He was pacing restlessly.
Retrenching hell, there's plenty of pickings left in California and Oregon and all those places. What I've been thinking is we ought to think of expanding. The way things are, there's nobody to stop us. It's there for the taking, Mexico and Canada, maybe. It ought to be a cinch.
Then she saw the answer. She saw the secret premise behind their words. With all of their noisy devotion to the age of science, their hysterically technological jargon, their cyclotrons, their sound rays, these men were moved forward not by the image of an industrial skyline, but by the vision of that form of existence which the industrialists had swept away. The vision of a fat, unhygienic Rajah of India, with vacant eyes staring in indolent stupor out of stagnant layers of flesh, with nothing to do but run precious gems through his fingers. And once in a while, stick a knife into the body of a starved, toil-dazed, germ-eaten creature, as a claim to a few grains of the creature's rice, then claim it from hundreds of millions of such creatures, and thus let the rice grains gather into gems. She had thought that industrial production was a value not to be questioned by anyone. She had thought that these men's urge to expropriate the factories of others was their acknowledgement of the factory's value. She, born of the Industrial Revolution, had not held as conceivable, had forgotten, along with the tales of astrology and alchemy, what these men knew in their secret, furtive souls, knew not by means of thought, but by means of that nameless muck which they called their instincts and emotions, that so long as men struggle to stay alive, they'll never produce so little but that the man with the club won't be able to seize it and leave them still less, provided millions of them are willing to submit. That the harder their work and the less their gain, the more submissive the fiber of their spirit. That men who live by pulling levers at an electric switchboard are not easily ruled, but men who live by digging the soil with their naked fingers are. That the feudal baron did not need electronic factories in order to drink his brains away out of jeweled goblets, and neither did the Rajahs of the People's State of India. She saw what they wanted, and to what goal their instincts, which they called unaccountable, were leading them. She saw that Eugene Lawson, the humanitarian, took pleasure at the prospect of human starvation, and Dr. Ferris, the scientist, was dreaming of the day when men would return to the hand plow. Incredulity and indifference were her only reaction. Incredulity because she could not conceive of what would bring human beings to such a state. Indifference because she could not regard those who reached it as human any longer. They went on talking, but she was unable to speak or to listen. She caught herself feeling that her only desire was now to get home and fall asleep. "Miss Taggart," said a politely rational, faintly anxious voice, and jerking her head up, she saw the courteous figure of a waiter. "The assistant manager of the Taggart terminal's on the telephone, requesting permission to speak to you at once. He says it's an emergency." It was a relief to leap to her feet and get out of that room, even if in answer to the call of some new disaster. It was a relief to hear the assistant manager's voice, even though it was saying, "The interlocker system is out, Miss Taggart. The signals are dead. There are 8 incoming trains held up and 6 outgoing. We can't move them in or out of the tunnels. We can't find the chief engineer. We can't locate the breach in the circuit. We have no copper wire for repairs. We don't know what to do. I'll be right down," she said, dropping the receiver. Hurrying to the elevator, then half running through the stately lobby of the Wayne Falkland, she felt herself returning to life at the summons of the possibility of action. Taxicabs were rare these days, and none came in answer to the doorman's whistle. She started rapidly down the street, forgetting what she wore, wondering why the touch of the wind seemed too cold and too intimately close. Her mind on the terminal ahead, she was startled by the loveliness of a sudden sight. She saw the slender figure of a woman hurrying toward her, the ray of a lamppost sweeping over lustrous hair, naked arms, the swirl of a black cape and the flame of a diamond on her breast, with the long empty corridor of a city street behind her, and skyscrapers drawn by lonely dots of light. The knowledge that she was seeing her own reflection in the side mirror of a florist's window came an instant too late. She had felt the enchantment of the full context to which that image and city belonged. Then she felt a stab of desolate loneliness, much wider a loneliness than the span of an empty street, and a stab of anger at herself, at the preposterous contrast between her appearance and the context of this night and age. She saw a taxi turn a corner. She waved to it and leaped in, slamming the door against a feeling which she hoped to leave behind her, on the empty pavement by a florist's window. But she knew, in self-mockery, in bitterness, in longing, that this feeling was the sense of expectation she had felt at her first ball, and at those rare times when she had wanted the outward beauty of existence to match its inner splendor. What a time to think of it, she told herself in mockery. Not now, she cried to herself in anger. But a desolate voice kept asking her quietly to the rattle of the taxi's wheels, "You who believed you must live for your happiness, what do you now have left of it? What are you gaining from your struggle? Yes, say it honestly. What's in it for you? Or are you becoming one of those abject altruists who has no answer to that question any longer?" "Not now," she ordered, as the glowing entrance to the Taggart terminal flared up in the rectangle of the taxi's windshield. The men in the terminal manager's office were like extinguished signals, as if here too a circuit were broken and there were no living current to make them move. They looked at her with a kind of inanimate passivity, as if it made no difference whether she let them stay still or threw a switch to set them in motion. The terminal manager was absent. The chief engineer could not be found. He had been seen at the terminal 2 hours ago, not since. The assistant manager had exhausted his power of initiative by volunteering to call her. The others volunteered nothing. The signal engineer was a college boyish man in his 30s, who kept saying aggressively, "But this has never happened before, Miss Taggart. The interlocker has never failed. It's not supposed to fail. We know our jobs. We can take care of it as well as anybody can, but not if it breaks down when it's not supposed to."